and may it please the Court. This case presents a single issue. When does the statute of limitations begin to run on a challenge to the use of a hiring eligibility list prepared from the results of a written examination and cutoff score alleged to have adverse impact? Our submission is that it began when plaintiffs were aware both that the exam had adverse impact and that they were not deemed well qualified to be hired based on their scores. In rejecting that defense, the district court erroneously ruled the Title VII violation continued as long as the hiring list was used. While this court has not addressed this precise issue, the time to challenge a tainted eligibility list has been litigated in four other circuits, which have split 2-2. But the two that found a continuing violation, the second in Guardians and the fifth in Gonzales, predate even the Supreme Court's decision in Ricks. These adverse decisions cannot be reconciled with Ricks or with any of the court's later decisions on continuing violations. The Third Circuit in Braun Shields and the Sixth in Cox properly take account of the later decisions, and we urge the court to align itself with those circuits.
Well, they say they needed time to find out whether the tests were, racially biased.
As I understand their argument, Judge Posner, is that they needed time to assess whether the test was valid. In other words, whether we would have a defense to the claim of adverse impact. They did not need time to assess whether the test had adverse impact. We actually admitted it around about the time we say the claim accrued in January 96.
But can you file a complaint without, if you have a defense staring you in the face, can you file a complaint without investigating the possible validity of that defense?
Well, there's two things, Your Honor. And the first is that, at most, that argument goes to tolling. It does not go to accrual. As this Court made clear in Davidson, and a large number of other cases have made clear as well. So in our view, the claim accrued in January of 96, and I will address tolling as the second part of my answer in just a minute. So that's the first thing, is that the possibility of a defense does not affect the accrual of the claim. And the second piece, of course, is that this was not a complaint filed in federal court. And while we don't suggest right. that people should go running to the EEOC and burden that agency, simply because they harbor some vague suspicion of some possible illegality, the city admitted adverse impact. That actually is enough for a prima facie case. Under this court's cases, the plaintiff, and I quote, awakens to the possibility of a claim long before he achieves certainty of being able to recover on that claim. The plaintiffs insist they were not looking for certainty, but there's absolutely no other way to explain why they waited to see if we might have a defense to the adverse impact that we actually admitted. That would get them past even a prima facie case in federal court, and it certainly was enough to trigger accrual.
Well, what's the difference between discovery and tolling, right? So you don't have to file until you've discovered you have a claim, and it's after you discover it that you may be able to delay suing because you just can't get the information you need to be able to file a complaint. Maybe you don't know who the defendant is, something of that sort.
Discovery and tolling may be quite similar in some respects, but neither of them actually applies here. In fact, the plaintiffs don't even argue. They don't even rely on the discovery rule, although they did in the district court. In CADA, this court explains that it's possible the discovery rule, or recognized that the discovery rule doesn't even apply to Title VII claims, although CADA was willing to assume that it did because the Supreme Court had indicated in Ricks that part of how it dated when Ricks' claim accrued is that the decision was communicated to Ricks. But discovery simply means the plaintiff's awareness that the plaintiff has been injured. And so to that extent, of course, it is similar to tolling. But as I say, plaintiffs in this court, although they do rely on tolling, do not rely on the discovery rule. And you know, among the reasons why tolling would be inappropriate here, in the Beeman case, for example, one of the reasons the court relied on there for why tolling was not appropriate is because the plaintiff knew that he had been injured. In fact, he consulted with the EEO officer at his employer within the period of the statute of limitations. Plaintiffs here consulted with an attorney within 3 months of January 96 when their claim accrued. They still had 10 more months to put a claim on file, and they simply have never accounted for all of the time. And tolling is sparingly applied. It has to be sparingly applied, or it will end run the statute of limitations. And this court, as I say, has not specifically addressed a hiring list, but it has addressed the identical legal issue in a variety of other contexts. And each time the court has held that where the plaintiff's claim is traced to the application to him of a facially neutral policy, and there is no evidence that the policy was applied in a discriminatory fashion, the claim accrues when the policy is adopted, not when it is applied to the plaintiff. In our briefs, we discuss a large number of these cases, the Davidson case, Hewells, Kennedy, Hamilton, Berger. All of those cases stand for the proposition that when something happens to you solely because of some discriminatory act in the past, but the policy that is applied to you to cause your injury is facially neutral, your claim accrues when the act of discrimination occurred. And here, that means that the plaintiff's claim accrued when they found out that the exam had adverse impact and that they were not deemed well qualified to be hired off of that exam. They challenged the hiring list, but the only basis on which the list is faulty and the only basis on which they ever complained about the list is that it reflected the exam with adverse impact and the cut score of 89. And regardless of any problems that went into making that list, when the list was used, there were no problems of any kind. There was no disparate impact. The list was used for random selection only. There was no intent in using the list. Our policy was quite simple. If you're on the list, you have a chance to be called. If you're not on the list, you have no chance to be called. That's a facially neutral policy, and it was applied in a facially neutral and even-handed manner. And under this court's cases, like the Supreme Court's cases, that means the claim accrued once in January 96. Plaintiffs make two responses to all of the cases that we cite. And the first is to deny that any case at all supports us. And the second is that all of the cases on which we rely involve disparate treatment and not disparate impact. That distinction actually makes no sense, but it's also not correct. Both the Bronze Shields case and the Davidson case involved adverse impact claims, and in both of those, the courts held, this court in Davidson and the Third Circuit in Bronze Shields, held that the claim accrued at the time of the only act alleged or proved to be unlawful, which in this case was the use of the exam with adverse impact and the cutoff score of 89. But more important, the distinction is actually groundless. There is no case that recognizes, suggests, or even hints that accrual depends on the type of evidence necessary to prove the underlying claim of discrimination. Plaintiffs also say that there is no prejudice to the city if the time bar is enforced, is not enforced against them. But the Supreme Court and many courts have explicitly noted that the statute of limitations in Title VII claims is short for a reason. It is a trade-off between the employee's right to take advantage of the civil rights laws and the employer's right to be protected from stale decisions. The statute of limitations is not a technicality. It serves important social interests in certainty, accuracy, and repose, as well as limiting back pay entitlements. And as Bronze Shields explains, this concern is particularly appropriate when the challenge is to an eligibility roster that is to be used for years. With permission, I'd reserve the balance of my time.
Certainly, Ms. Sullivan. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you. The starting point, I think, in this case is that the issue of accrual is not antiseptically unrelated to the merits of what happened below. Here we have an 8-day trial in which a judge made a series of findings, and we know for purposes of accrual that there are two decisions that have to be examined by the court. Number one, the identification of the specific employment practice at issue, and second, as Ledbetter reminds us, when did that violation take place? And is there a violation within 300 days of the date that the charges were filed?
I don't really see what the difference is between. I don't see what the difference is between a case like this and a case like Rick's. That as soon as an act occurs that, you know, dooms you in a sense, makes it extremely likely that you're going to have, there's going to be an adverse consequence, then the statute of limitations starts to run.
Well, I think that's not the case. The difference between, first in Ricks and those types of cases, the claim is a disparate treatment claim. The essential component is intent.
I don't know what difference it makes. I mean, a decision is made. In this case, it's the exam, and Ricks was the denied tenure, whatever they did. And the decision, although it has no immediate consequence, puts you at some future disadvantage.
Let me go back two steps here. First of all, we know from Griggs and its progeny that a practice that operates to exclude African Americans and is not job-related is prohibited. Those are the words of Griggs.
I don't know what that connects to what I'm asking about.
Well, because the point is that there, unlike the Ricks case, where there was no violation within the 300-day period, the only violation existed when the professor...
Well, that's just words, right? Because when he loses his job, you could say, wow, that's the violation. That's when my income ceased, right?
But the
court said no. It's perfectly sensible. As soon as you know you are about to be hurt, that's the violation. And, I mean, if someone said to you, look, we don't like black people, we don't like white people, so we're going to fire you in 6 months, right? Well, the statute of limitations runs now, even though they may change their mind, right?
Firm decision,
so
that's right.
So why is this different?
This is different because every time, and what the trial court found, and what is the teaching in Morgan, and what is the teaching in Lawrence, and I'd like to walk through Lawrence with you, but the point here is that every time they use the list, first, the use of the 8-9 cut score created two pools, a pool that was overwhelmingly white, five times as white as the other pool, and a pool that was disproportionate.
Mr. Miner, if you would stand in front of the microphone, all the millions of fans who will be downloading this from the Internet will appreciate it.
I apologize to all of them. The point is that every time the list is used, it has all of the elements of a disparate impact claim. As the judge found, the use of the 8-9 cut score created two pools, an overwhelmingly white pool and a disproportionately black pool. The criteria for dividing them, the 8-9 score, was not job-related. It was never intended for that purpose at all. And as a consequence, every time they used the list, they picked from a pool that was...
What would you do with this case? Suppose that the employer says, we don't like black people, so we're cutting your salary in half. Are you going to say that every time he receives his half paycheck, that's a new violation?
That's Ledbetter. And the answer to that question is, if there's a policy that said, we're going to pay all blacks half of what we pay whites, every time they paid him, we have a Bazemore situation, and the answer is yes, there'd be a violation. If this is a single decision by a racist manager and says, I simply don't like you, I don't like you because you're black, and I'm going to cut your pay in half, and the person has 300 days from that intentional act because an essential component of that violation
right.
is
and
the intent.
I just don't see the difference between that case and this case.
Well, because in that case, the pay structure is not discriminatory, number one, and there's no intentional act each time the paycheck issues. So what Ledbetter teaches us is it happens.
But that's so metaphysical. Why would you make a difference? Why would you make a distinction like that?
That's precisely the distinction the Supreme Court made in Lorenz.
What's the logic of making that kind of distinction?
Because what the courts are saying is that there has to be a violation, an actual violation within the 300-day period. If there's not a violation, then you're out of luck. And the point of an impact case, and every one of the impact cases we cite supports that conclusion, namely the fact that you knew that there was a wrong. They all knew that at some point a policy or practice was adopted, and it was applied on a number of occasions. And the court routinely says you can sue every time you're impacted by it, because every time you're impacted, there's a wrong, because every time you're impacted, all of the elements of the wrong come into play, adverse impact, lack of job relatedness, and preferring the majority group over the minority group for no legitimate reason. That makes it a violation. In the disparate treatment cases, you simply don't have a violation. And if we go back to Lorenz, which is, to me, the seminal case here, in Lorenz, the court made it absolutely clear, number one, that it was taking the case to address this issue. How do we deal with the statute of limitations in a disparate impact case? Exactly what the court says is, the question taken by the court was when the statute of limitation begins to run in a lawsuit arising out of a seniority system not alleged to be discriminatory on its face or is presently applied. The court then, Scalia goes ahead and explains that at the next page, petitioner's allegation of a disparate impact on men and women would ordinarily suffice to state a claim under Section 702A2. And citing Griggs, but the problem they have is that unlike other practices, and there's no other practice that has this protection, seniority systems.
I didn't understand that. So what if a company said didn't want to have black workers, so it said we only hire people with PhDs? Okay, so that would be a disparate impact.
Sure would.
Right?
It could be. Well, if it's not job related, correct.
So. Why should statute of limitations in a case like that be different from the statute of limitations in a case like Rick's?
Well, because the court says it is. Because there's no...
Is there a reason for it?
The teaching of Rick's... I submit the teaching of Rick's is clear.
No, but what's the sense of the distinction between those two cases?
Because the university did nothing wrong after it made this individual discriminatory...
Well, that's a very strange argument. It did nothing wrong.
I also don't understand the argument. One of the issues that comes up in cases like Rick's is what happens when the professor appeals through the university's bureaucracy. And there are a whole series of appeals once you get your letter saying you won't be reappointed.
But the court treat... I'm sorry.
And we've had a series of cases in which people say... Each of those subsequent decisions starts a new period of limitations. And as you know, we've rejected that argument. That's Lieber against Northwestern.
Right.
And that seems to be, the argument you're making here to distinguish Rick's seems to be the argument that we considered and rejected in Lieber. Is there some material difference?
Well, I think there is. And I think the Supreme Court identified it in, well, first of all, let me just go back to the city's position. The city admits, because every case is so held, a facially discriminatory policy that is fully known when it's adopted in every one of its details becomes accrues every time it's applied.
I don't regard disparate impact and disparate treatment as disparate. Disparate impact is really a kind of circumstantial evidence approach to disparate treatment. So I don't see why the statute of limitations rules should be different. So if you could give me a practical reason, not mentioning a case, but just a practical reason why it makes sense to give people more time, could be a lot more time, in the disparate impact case, I would be grateful.
Well, I think the practical reason is that the law proscribes, does not tolerate.
That certainly is not going to be a practical reason if you're telling me what the law prescribes.
Well, the reality is...
I could ask you, why should statute of limitations be 10 years on a written contract and 2 years on an oral contract. And you could give me a reason without talking about the law. So now why should the statute of limitations be longer for disparate impact than disparate treatment cases?
I'm sorry, why should
the statute of limitations be longer for disparate impact cases than for disparate treatment cases?
You know, it's hard for me to answer that without explaining what the law is and how every court has addressed it. No court has said otherwise. And in this court...
No, come on now. Look, suppose as a matter of policy, I asked you, you're a legislator, do you want to set a longer statute of limitations for disparate impact than for disparate treatment? And if so, why?
But the court, Title VII itself recognizes
it. Look, answer my question. You're a legislator. You don't know anything about the law. You're just being asked, as a matter of policy, do you think it's better to have a longer statute of limitations in a disparate impact case than in a disparate treatment case?
I think the answer is yes. I think that
why?
Because in a disparate impact case, a discriminatory act has occurred. All the components of that act have occurred. The company has continued to follow, just as in Taylor and Merrick, the case this court has written.
Yeah, that's very unsatisfactory to me, because if you ask whether the policies behind statute of limitations, evidence, disappearing, interest in repose, difficulty for a plaintiff of investigating and finding out if he's been harmed, you know, preservation of evidence. That's why statute of limitations on written contracts are longer than on oral. So there are all these practical reasons that go into the decision. Now, what would be a practical reason for wanting to have a longer statute of limitations for disparate impact cases?
Because the company that is following the discriminatory practice has made a decision to continue to use it, notwithstanding the fact that it has adverse impact, notwithstanding the fact that every time they use it, they're preferring whites over equally qualified African-Americans, or they're preferring men over equally qualified women. And the minute they stop using it, the statute runs, and then they get their repose 300 days later. And the Act itself recognizes that there's a two-year back pay component for people who bring timely charges, which recognizes that there's no magic in this 300 days. If you bring a proper lawsuit, then, in fact, you can go back 200 days.
Why couldn't this claim have been filed within 300 days?
Well, the answer to that is quite simple, Judge Posner. Having been the person responsible for it, in 1995, the law was clear. Practical or not, no court had ever held that the filing of a charge within 300 days in a disparate impact claim was a requirement. Every court, Bauman, Beaver, Second Circuit's Bridgeport case, this court's case in Webb, which it talked about continuing violations and relies on the Bridgeport case, Gonzalez in the Fifth Circuit.
So you're not saying
and
it would
and
have
Lorenz,
been,
which is
so you're not saying it would have been infeasible to file a claim.
I think it would have been the imprudent thing to do, knowing two things, knowing that the city had publicly announced not just that the test was valid, but that we have spent $5 million and we have come up with a device that clearly distinguishes well-qualified from...
But if you filed this administrative claim, would you be subject to sanctions if it turned out that it had no merit?
Now, this was 10 years ago, but I'm going to tell you what I'm pretty sure I was thinking. The bigger threat to lawyers who do what we do is that within a short order, the EEOC would have shot back a right to sue letter, because they do that often. We're not going to have time to get at it. We have to send it to Washington. Now I've got 90 days to file the lawsuit, and it is jurisdictional, and I don't know whether the city's declaration, dishonest, we know, and we knew they knew it all, now we know they knew it all the time. Their declaration that we had selected the white guys because they were clearly better. We spent $5 million on an industrial psychologist who had a reputation in our circles for racial fairness, for doing it fairly, and he had come up with a new component called a video component, and this actually distinguished well-qualified from qualified. We don't like the results, but we're going to have to live with them. That was all a fraud. And we had no evidence to suggest otherwise, and I know from my experience to jump into a case like this was going to be a war. The costs of these cases are astronomical. And the notion that it was inappropriate, particularly since, A, the city had it, and the argument that, well, there's no requirement when they have it, that's not true. The regulations...
But the way you describe the test in your brief, you make it sound ridiculous.
The test? Well, we know that now.
Well, you make it sound ridiculous in a way that does not require a degree in psychology. So couldn't they have told you... This test is ridiculous. It doesn't have any connection to
Our clients have been put through a video component that they found very complicated.
So they could describe to you what the test was, surely.
Did you
have a copy of the test?
No. Do I now? Oh, sure, I didn't then. They don't let them take it with them.
But they could have told you what the test was like, right?
Judge, I know that the city has spent $5 million on a very prominent industrial psychologist who claimed to develop a whole new approach to the video component that was going to be racially neutral and was going to be fair and was really going to test for these skills. And so we didn't know. And we know that the city had publicly declared that we have a way of distinguishing. And I'd like to just point out, just on the whole tolling issue, the city takes issue with the fact, and let me just go back one second, because I know the case law...
You can finish answering Judge Posner's question, but your time has expired.
On the question of this tolling issue, every fact that we cite was a finding by the court. We didn't cherry-pick facts out and surprise the city with facts they didn't know about. These were heavily litigated issues. They were all admitted to in the Horan case. They're undisputed, and the theme of them is...
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Solomon?
Just very briefly, Your Honors. Mr. Minor began his argument, if I heard it correctly, with the idea that accrual is not antiseptically unrelated to the merits. And running through his argument is the idea that we repeatedly violated the plaintiff's rights. But the continuation of prior discrimination is not enough. That's exactly the difference between Ledbetter and Bazemore. Those cases would not have come out differently if continuation of prior discrimination was enough. Here, the employment practice at issue was the use of the exam with the 89 cut score. And to be clear, we used the cut score only once when we made the list. Thereafter, we just used the list. This is not a semantic difference. It is, as I explained, the difference between a new violation and the effects of the prior violation. And it is the salient feature on which accrual turns. Mr. Minor, I think, agrees with this, but he thinks we violated Title VII every time we used the list. He did not allege that, and he did not prove that. There was nothing wrong with the list. Taking the pool of candidates on the list, the use of the list had no adverse impact. The only adverse impact was in comparing the list with the pool of applicants who sat for the exam. So the use of the list itself had no adverse impact. And again, as I indicated, the list was used to make random selections. It could have no adverse impact. It could have no disparate treatment. And neither of those was proved. Continuing to follow the list, failing to take it down...
You mean given who was on it?
Given who was on it, exactly right, Your Honor. And that is why we focus on the creation of the list. Yes, to take Rick's one step further... If Ricks had been locked out of his office the day after his terminal contract expired, he could not have sued over that because people who don't have contracts with the university are entitled to be locked out of their office. One thing happened to Ricks and one thing happened to these plaintiffs. We did not put them on the hiring eligibility list. It is not enough that we continue to use that list thereafter. Failing to remedy adverse impact, even if the employer knows about it, and failing to take any steps to equalize treatment is not independently actionable. We cite a half a dozen cases on page 6 through 8 of our reply brief for those precise propositions. The only time it matters if the employer fails to change a prior policy is when that prior policy is facially discriminatory. That is the difference between Ledbetter and Bazemore, and that is why we rely on Bazemore. I'm sorry. That is why we rely on Ledbetter. Bazemore, in fact, according to Ledbetter, is not even a continuing violation case. In Ledbetter, Ledbetter explains that Bazemore found a present violation. In fact, it is perverse to extend the statute of limitations for only disparate treatment claims, as between the two
disparate
types...
Disparate impact.
Pardon, Your Honor?
Disparate impact.
It is perverse to extend the statute of limitations, thank you, for disparate impact claims, as between the two types of conduct, disparate treatment is far more culpable, and all of the other policies are exactly the same for the two types of cases. To the extent that Mr. Minor argues he was misled by thinking by other cases, and he cited a number of them here, O'Grady and Reb and Beeman and the other cases he mentioned, those cases involved facially discriminatory policies. That's why they come out the way they do. This case does not. And for that reason, we ask that the judgment of the district court be reversed.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.